Is it extremely hot upstairs in the balcony? If you will, why don't you open all the windows that you can there on both sides if you feel that you can stand the cooler air? And those down here on this side, you may want to open those windows over there, Jack. You want to, can you reach that or not? That one you can reach, all right. May God bless us while we study together today. It's a great privilege to be together as a body. I encourage you to think with me through a message that I feel is very important. Some months ago in Manhattan, New York, there was a meeting of what Time magazine described as 100 intellectuals came together for a meeting on the subject, the end of the rationalist tradition. Now, rationalism in this respect, what they meant to convey by that term, actually atheism, a system or a philosophy where actually man's reason has been exalted to a position of revelation, and where man himself has been exalted to the position of a god. And that's been the course of the world for the last several years and several decades. And the result that you see around about us in the corruption, the ungodliness, the lack of direction, the dishonesty, and all the rest that can be traced today can be traced, I think, basically to a basic philosophy that the world adopted some years ago, the philosophy of this thing of rationalism, where man felt that he was the highest intelligence and his reasoning was the highest revelation. And this meeting was called, and these 100 men were brought together to discuss, is this the end of the rationalist tradition? And it said that gloom hung thick over that audience, and that the men there were very pessimistic. Poet Robert Lowell made the statement, the world is absolutely out of control now, and it's not going to be saved by reason or unreason. Norman Mailer said, somewhere something incredible happened in history. The wrong guys won. We find this pessimism pervading this group of men, rightly so. Because as you look around about you, it seems that the forces of evil are actually encompassing the body of Christ and would actually snuff us out. They spoke of it as the battle having been in past tense. These men described it as having already been finished, that we were washed up. I do not believe that the battle is over. I do not believe, however, that we can ever look forward to a time whenever good will replace evil on this earth. I don't believe the Bible talks about it in that light. In fact, in Revelation, the 20th chapter, the Bible specifically says that the forces of evil, just prior to the second coming of Jesus Christ, would number so many as the sands of the sea, and that they would march up over the breadth of the earth and would encompass the church of God, or the saints, the camp of the saints, the city of the living God, the New Jerusalem. And it speaks of it as being such a force that you could almost say that it was hopeless. In fact, the picture that's given there in Revelation 20 is that the only thing that saves the situation was that God himself specifically, divinely intervened. And there came down from heaven, the Bible says, a fire, and it devoured the enemy. That's the picture that you get. So I don't think that the time will ever come when you and I will ever see righteousness take the place of ungodliness in this world. I think it's hopeless in that respect. But at the same time, as long as you and I as Christians are living, then the task is up to us to carry on the fight. There'll never be a time when you can sheath your sword, draw in your sword, and cease from the battle. We'll always have to be involved on the front line of fighting against evil. I don't know whether you're equipped for that battle or not, but I'm confident that there'll never be a time when we can cease the battle and put our swords in their sheaths. In fact, Jesus Christ in Matthew the 10th chapter stated his basic approach to the world. And he states it not for just himself, he states it for you and me. And he says, "Do not think that I have come into the world to bring peace. I haven't come to bring peace, but a sword." And he said, "It'll be so that a man will be at variance with his father, and a daughter with her mother, and a daughter-in-law with her mother-in-law. And it shall be that a man's own enemies will be those of his own household." This is the statement that Jesus made, and in it, he states more or less a mode of operation. He states a plank in his operation. He's simply saying this. In this statement where Jesus says, "I did not come to bring peace but a sword," Jesus was saying, "I hereby renounce coexistence with the world. And I hereby take the position of confrontation with the world. These two opinions, these two ideologies cannot be homogenized. You either take a position of coexistence with evil or you take a position of confrontation with evil." Jesus says, "My position is a position of confrontation, not coexistence." Today, you and I are standing at a crossroads. People, I'm not trying to blow up anything out of proportion, and I'm not trying to be melodramatic, but I'm here today to serve notice in some respects that either you and I recognize that we're coming and are now at the forks of the road and have come to a parting of the ways with the world, or else we're going to be swallowed up with the world. The sooner we recognize what Paul mentions in Ephesians, the 4th chapter, verse 17, the better off we're going to be. The Apostle Paul there says we've come to a parting of the way. He says, "Now at this I affirm and testify in the Lord that you must no longer live as the Gentiles do in the futility of their minds." I mentioned this last Sunday to the first service. I didn't mention it to you. It slipped my mind. And yet it was a very major point, and I want to bring it to your attention today. The Apostle Paul is saying here that you and I must come to realize that we can no longer live like the nation in which we're living. The sooner we recognize that we are living in a country that does not agree with, nor is it any longer built upon, nor guided by the principles of Jesus Christ, the sooner we'll be able to rescue our position and solidify and make our identity firm with the world. I think the sooner we realize the fact that we're no longer living in a country committed to Christian principles, the more easily we'll find our task of identifying ourselves with Jesus Christ and standing up and making any difference in this world. Jesus Christ expects you and me to be confronters. He does not expect us to be conformers. And yet we have in the church today an entire generation of people, if we're not careful, because of the fact that we felt like and have for years that we are living in a Christian country. Therefore, we feel that anything that comes out of this Christian country must be fairly synonymous with Christianity. That's not true. And we need to come to the realization that we are now, today, right now, and for some years past, we are living in a country that it basically, as far as its practical direction is concerned, it is in direct opposition to the principles that Jesus Christ taught. And you're going to have to make a decision. Am I going to go with this nation, or am I going to no longer live according to the nation and the way they live? That's the instruction that Paul has given us. The modern Jewish nation has a motto that they have adopted. That motto, simply stated, is two words: never again. Never again. And I don't have to stand here this morning and explain to you what the Jew means today when he says never again. Perhaps for those of you who do not know what the implication is, it's simply this: never again will we allow ourselves to be put in a position to be the victims of the inhumanities of man that have characterized us over the centuries. Never again. I maintain that you and I must adopt us a motto also, and that the motto for the Christian is found in Ephesians, the 4th chapter, verse 17, when Paul uses the two words, "no longer." No longer. The time past may suffice for our having lived like that. But he says, "no longer." And that just simply means no longer will we imitate the world. No longer will we ignore the direction that the world is going. No longer will we bury and hide the things that the world is doing. No longer will we imitate it and be like the world. No longer will we remain silent. And I want to serve notice today to any of you that would doubt it. I'm taking the stand that this is my motto. No longer will I ever remain silent on anything that I feel like is God's will for you. No matter how ticklish or how embarrassing it may be to mention, no longer will I remain silent. I intend to do exactly what the Apostle Paul says here. Now this I affirm and testify in the Lord, that you must no longer live as the Gentiles do in the futility of their minds. The word Gentile ought to be translated in a different way. The word Gentile is simply the Greek word ethnoi, which means the nations, which means the people of whatever country that you're living in who are not servants of God. You cannot go on imitating those people. There must come a time when there's a split. You must take your route that leads to God and let them go the route that they wish. If they please, go the way they please, but you'll not be going with them. I maintain that we're at that position today. Are you prepared to take that position? Are you prepared to enter into the fight, to the battle? I'm convinced that if we're not prepared, then we're not prepared to stand with Jesus Christ. We must be a people who are able to discern the times. You know, when it comes right down to it, we're really very naive and foolish. We really can't understand what's going on about us. And all of a sudden, until it's finally or has overwhelmed us, we're unaware of what the designs of Satan are. Paul wasn't. The early Christians were. And Paul says you need to take an inventory of the way you're living. Look carefully how you're walking. And don't walk like foolish men, but walk as wise men. Redeeming the times because the days are evil. I think we need to be a people who are able to discern the times. The Apostle Paul and his day saw a condition in the Roman world that is almost beyond description. I have drawn from the several sources of history, several historians, some comments, and I have compiled them in one brief statement that describes the condition of the Roman world in the first century. And I want you to benefit from it this morning. Quoting, and these are either quotes or paraphrases, all ranks of Roman society were infected with the prevailing impurity. Vices which may not even be named were practiced with impunity. Slavery encouraged sensual indulgence. Infanticide was freely tolerated and practiced. In the Roman stage, the circus and amphitheater, the degradation of morals was most apparent. Again, divorce was coming to be looked upon with the utmost indifference. The loss of belief in the old religion and the growing laxity of morals led to an extraordinary freedom of divorce. No remedy was found for a disorder so universal. And I could go on and take up the entire hour reading to you quotations that describe the degradation of the first century A.D. Roman world. But that's not my point. My point this morning is that in your lifetime and in mine, in 20th century America, we are witnessing the same conditions in our generation as they did back there. If you were to substitute American for Roman in these statements that I've just read, you would see that we are today reproducing an exact replica of the corruptions of the first century age. Furthermore, if you were to take these statements that I've made about the ranks of Roman society, about the vices which cannot even be mentioned, about the other things, the slavery which produced such opportunity for unbridled lust, if you were to take those things and substitute contemporary practices, you would see a parallel that would be shocking. For example, if you'll substitute, and I don't want you to misunderstand what I say, it has been misunderstood as I've quoted this before. When I refer to these, the laboring force, the female working force in the world today, I do not have in mind Christian women. I'm taking it for granted that those of you who are Christian women and who are working, that you are serving as a salt influence in this corrupt age, and you're perhaps part of the very end of the reason why part of the reason why it can continue in any semblance of decency at all. I'm assuming that you are doing your job of influencing the world for good. But it must be said this morning that the female workforce in America and in the world has been one of the greatest contributing factors to the immorality that the world has ever seen. I do not see how we can escape the conviction and the conclusion that the female working force, whenever the females of the world have been put into the working force of the world, they've been taken advantage of, they've been put in compromising positions, and they've been forced, much like the slaves of the first century were forced, to gratify the sensual desires of the male population. That's number one. I think it's parallel. Secondly, we find that if you were to substitute abortion for infanticide, you'd have the same practice today that you had back in the first century. If you were to substitute the American stage or the American theater for the Roman theater, you have the identical situation today, and perhaps even worse than you had back then. If you were then to add to that the same freedom of divorce that existed in the first century A.D. Roman world, that same condition exists today almost without any exception whatever. The freedom of it is almost totally parallel. Then add to that alcoholism, drug addiction, the spiraling crime rate, the mafia, which is an international web of corruption, plus the Watergate affair and all the implications of that. You add all of this together, and you come to the same conclusion that E. de Preissance came to when he said, we find ourselves in a sink of vice. And brethren, the sooner we recognize that, the sooner we're going to be able to stand up and take our place as Christians and make our light shine and make our position known and make it felt in the world. And unless we're able to do that, we're not going to make any impact upon this world in which we're living. We're going to have to come to the position that Jesus came to. He says, don't conform, confront. Don't put up with coexistence. Demand confrontation. And I don't know whether you're ready for that or not, but I'm simply saying this. Jesus says, unless you're willing to do it, you're ashamed of me. And I'm going to be ashamed of you when I come before my Father in that great day. In Mark, the 8th chapter, verse 38, Jesus said, if any man is ashamed of me and of my teachings in this adulterous and sinful generation, I'm going to be ashamed of him before my Father and before his holy angels. We dare not accept that which God has placed his curse upon. We need to recognize that we're no longer living in a Christian world, and certainly no longer in a Christian nation. But a second thing that we're going to have to do, if you're prepared for this confrontation, we're going to each one have to be dedicated to a life of purity. In the book of Ephesians, and if you have your Bible and want to turn, I'm going to refer to these very briefly. Our time is not sufficient this morning, but I'm going to refer to these, and you mark them and go home and study them. You're going to have to be dedicated and committed to a life of purity. For one thing, there are certain things in life that do not even deserve the honor of being debated by a Christian as having any part in the Christian's life. He mentioned six of these: immorality, impurity, and covetousness, filthiness, silly talk, and levity. The first three of these, we are fairly well understanding of what they mean. When he talks about immorality and impurity, these have to do with the sexual vices that so plague the world today, and the sexual inappropriateness that has so saturated the minds of the world today. And we understand what these mean. And anything that contributes to immorality, anything that contributes to filthiness, anything that contributes to covetousness is to be shunned by the Christian, and it's not even to be named among Christian people. How dare any group of people come together in a conclave to discuss whether or not homosexuality is a part of the Christian life? How dare they? These are things that have no part. Paul says they're not even to be named among you. They're not even to be discussed as being appropriate. How could you ever possibly expect such things as this to have any part in the Christian life? And you can go on and name them, and covetousness is another one that you and I might really like not to be here, because I suspect that of all the sins of the world, this one is the one that grabs a hold of most of us and convicts us more than anything else, and that's this thing of covetousness. We're not talking about just simply the coveting of money, but the vice of self-assertion, ruthless in trampling on the rights of other people, concerned with nothing but the satisfaction of its own impulses. This is the key to the whole viciousness of pagan or worldly life, just as surely as love is the key to the whole goodness of the Christian life. He goes on and names these other things of filthiness, silly talk, and levity. He's not talking, I don't think, about the good, clean merriment that you and I as Christians enjoy with each other. He is talking, I think, about making a joke out of indecency and making a big, hilarious thing and painting over and kind of joking about that which is so indecent among us. And that also can be part of our lives. Paul says, don't let it be a part. He says, don't even let it be named among you. We're going to have to be dedicated to this thing of a life of purity, to the point that you'll say, you know, there are certain things that I simply will not even countenance. There are certain things that I'll not listen to. There are certain things that I'll not have a part in, and I won't even discuss it. I won't even give it the honor of discussing it as having a part in the Christian life. That's what Paul is saying here. But then a third thing, and this probably gets right to the root of the whole issue, we're going to have to come to a place where our attitudes towards sin are God's attitudes towards sin. And Brethren, as long as they're at variance with God's attitude, you can just simply know that there's no hope for cleaning up our lives. There's no hope for making our impact in the world really and truly felt until our attitudes come to be the attitudes of God. The outcome of sin's threat depends upon the attitude of Christian people towards sin. Our generation, and when I say our, I mean you and me, Dr. Benson and all of those who are his age, me and all of those who are my age, the rest of us and all of you who are your age, all of us are here, we're living and we're alive and we're being affected by this threat of sin upon us. We're going to have to realize that our attitude towards sin is going to be the outcome or will determine the outcome of sin's threat on the church today. We've come to the place where sin no longer really appears to be sin to us. We've grown accustomed to our face. We've kind of become such now that it's become second nature with us. We don't really find ourselves being surprised. We really can't be shocked. We find ourselves being lacking in indignation. We just simply find that we've become more or less accustomed to it. Someone said, vice is a monster of so great mien, but to be hated is but to be seen. But seen too often, familiar with her face, we first pity, and then endure, and then embrace. And that's been the pattern that the world has always followed. That's been the pattern that the church has always followed. If it's seen too much and we've become too familiar with it, it's come to the place that there's no line of demarcation today between sin and righteousness. And our younger generation has been brainwashed. And those of us who are in the next generation, we've almost done the same thing. We've almost been brainwashed. We're getting it from every side. We're getting it through television. We're getting it through our magazines. We're getting it through every medium of communication today to the place that we actually can't tell what's right and what's wrong. And we've just simply smeared the thing over to where everything is gray. Nothing is right. Nothing is wrong. When the time comes that we get like that, brethren, we are in trouble. God placed a curse upon those in Isaiah who called evil good and who called good evil. And what he was simply saying was they'd gotten to the place that they could no longer recognize when sin was sin. And they could no longer recognize when goodness was goodness. God says it's pitiful. Woe unto you that call good evil and evil good. That same curse is placed upon you and me today. And those who refuse or who fail to identify sin as sin are just simply one step back from where Isaiah said this woe was placed. God says to those that call good evil and evil good, there was a woe placed upon them. There's a woe on us today if we can't recognize the difference between good and evil. God's attitude towards sin is wrath. Wrath! In 1 Corinthians, the 6th chapter, says that this is simply such is the case. He said, people like this will not enter the kingdom of God. Be not deceived, neither fornicators, nor idolaters, nor adulterers, nor effeminate, nor abusers of themselves with men, homosexuals, nor thieves, nor covetous, nor drunkards, nor extortioners, nor revilers, shall enter the kingdom of heaven. Such were some of you, but you were washed, he said. In Romans, the 1st chapter, verse 18, he makes the same statement there, that the wrath of God has been revealed from heaven against all ungodliness of men and all unrighteousness of men that hinder the truth in unrighteousness. This is God's statement of his punishment upon this kind of living. I dare say that we dare not condone or ignore or overlook or wink at or minimize those things that God has simply spoken out and said, how dare you practice such things? They're not to be known among my people. Paul said to the Ephesians, you didn't learn Christ like this. This is not what you learned about him. Dare we endorse social drinking today in the light of the statistics? Dare we endorse the modern dance in the light of the statistics? Dare we endorse, if you please, the miniskirt in the light of the stated design of it and in the light of the statistics that have followed the introduction of this piece of apparel, this half of a piece of apparel. Mary Quant made a statement, and in the statement, she's the one that designed the thing. Mary Quant, London designer and mother of the miniskirt, said on November the 13th, 1968, many clothes are symbolic of those girls who want to seduce a man. Now, girls, let me tell you something. If this is your design, if this is what you're out to do, I don't mean to attract him to be a husband in a legal and a God-fearing marriage. I'm talking about what she said was the design of this miniskirt. It is designed to seduce a man. If that's your purpose, then go on and do it. But may I say to you that the instruction given by God to Christian women is that they dress themselves as women becoming godliness or professing godliness. That's God's statement to the Christian woman. He says here simply that you dare not condone that which God has placed his disapproval upon. I can't do it. And may I just simply say, no longer. That's my motto from now on. No longer will I allow the world to push us into following their design. No longer will I allow ourselves to just follow along like the blind, following the blind. I'm not going to do it as long as I'm here in this pulpit, and the elders may pull me out, but I don't think they will. When I find that there are things that are contrary to the very life that a Christian ought to be living, no longer will I be silent. And I'm calling upon every one of you to stand up for Jesus Christ today and say, no longer will I let the world crowd me into being like it. I'm going to start standing up for Jesus Christ and being what I ought to be. We need to recognize that we're living in an age that would absolutely destroy us. And if we don't take this stand, we're going to find ourselves fighting against God. And more so, we're going to find God fighting against us. In the book of Jeremiah, in chapter 9, verses 4 through 7, God there made a statement that's enough to make the hair on your neck stand up. Listen. And the Lord said to him, go through the city, through Jerusalem, and put a mark upon the foreheads of the men who sigh and groan over all the abominations that are committed in it. And to the others, he said, in my hearing, pass through the city after him, and smite, your eyes shall not spare, and you shall show no pity. Slay old men outright, young men and maidens, little children and women, but touch no one upon whom the mark is, and began at my sanctuary. In other words, began at the church. So they began with the elders who were before the house. Then he said to them, defile the house, fill the courts with the slain, go forth. So they went forth, and they smote the city. Listen, that scared the daylights out of me when I first read that some months ago. He's just simply saying that those people who will not stand with him in his condemnation of sin, he's saying, I'm marking you, and you're going to be killed, you're going to be destroyed. I maintain that we need to come to the place where we recognize that the quality of the Christian life is such that it demands confrontation with the world. There are three things I must say before we close. These three things are found in Ephesians, the fifth chapter. Beginning in verse 7. He states here the mode of operation, how we're going to combat this evil. Listen to what he says. First of all, he says, therefore do not associate with them. After he got through saying it's because of these things that the wrath of God is coming, he says here, three things I expect you to do as followers of Christ. Number one, do not associate with them. Now that's pretty strong language. The with them here is in the genitive case. And it implies, because of that fact, that we're talking here about the people who are involved in all this sin and corruption. Paul says you don't associate with them. In Psalms 1 and 1, blessed is the man who doesn't walk in the counsel of the wicked, nor stand in the way of sinners, nor sit in the seat of scoffers, but his delight's in the law of the Lord. That's still good advice today for young and old. In 1 Corinthians, the 15th chapter, verse 33, Paul makes the statement there that evil companionships corrupt good morals. And he's chides these people and says, what's the matter with you? Awake to common sense. Come on, what's the matter with you? How come you to ever think that companionship with evil people would not bring about a corruption of your own morals? Awake. Awake to sober thinking, he said. He says you cannot have any part with them. And that simply means if you're running around with a bunch of people whose lives show that they're living in direct opposition to God, stop it. Stop it. I don't care, he says, if it's your mother and your daddy. He said, if any man loves father or mother more than me, he's not worthy of me. Jesus says, say, confront it. Don't coexist with it. Confront it. He's demanding that we take that stand today. And it's becoming more and more apparent today that this stand is necessary if you and I as Christians are going to be the kind of people God expects us to be. The second thing he says is this. Take no part in them. This in them here is in the dative case. And it means the sins that are being practiced. Don't have anything to do with it. There are some sins probably that you wouldn't have any part in. But there are a lot of other sins that we flirt with and we get so close to that it's hard to tell who's a member of the church and who's not. Paul says here, don't have any part. Take no part in these sins. Let me just mention a few of them to show you what I mean. I'm talking about lewd, filthy films. If you're in the movie show, the movie business, don't show these films. If you're in the movie viewing business, don't view them. Don't go down here on Ray Street to the movie house. If it's showing a lewd, vulgar film, simply do not go there. And this is a requirement that's placed upon you, not by me. This is something that God says. Don't have any part in it. All right, you may think, ooh, you've really blown it. What? You lost me. Maybe so. But I'm not going to let God lose you because of an inability of me to speak out and warn you about some of these things. Listen to something else. The pornographic books and the lewd literature, the magazines that are so prevalent in the world tonight or today, and it is night. These things are absolutely things that a Christian has no part in at all. How can you go around reading lewd, vulgar literature and expect to be a follower of Jesus Christ? And yet over in the dorms, you've got him over there by the bushelful. If we would go around and collect all the lewd literature on this campus and in the homes of some of our own people whose children have it, we don't even know they have it, well, it'd fill up many a box full. Don't think it wouldn't. If you don't believe it, go home and check out your home. Go back and check out your dorm room. Check out your schoolmate or your roommate. Brethren, I think the time has come when we need to simply stand up and say, I'm not going to any longer countenance such as that. I'm going to stand up for Jesus Christ. Degrading music and by degraded musicians whose lives are literally a spit in the face of God and whose music is so degrading, isn't it time we stood up and said, look here, I'm not going to have any part in that anymore. I'm through with it. I'm through with letting the world dictate what I listen to. I'm through with the world dictating what I look at. I'm through with the world dictating what I wear. I'm through with the world dictating and making me a part of their life. I'm not going to do that anymore. Can you say with me this morning, no longer. God help me, no longer. Will that be that which characterizes my life? I'm taking a stand and I want you to take it with me. And if you've already taken it, God bless you. But if you haven't, you need to take it today. I'll tell you one thing. I wouldn't have you go along and imitate the materialism and the hypocrisy of an older generation at all. That's not what I'm asking you as young people to do. At the same time, I would say this. You need to flee from the blindness and the same hypocrisy that you see, that you fail to see in your own generation. It's there, you just can't see it. What I would say that God is asking us to do is simply this. Stand up for Jesus Christ and renounce what's wrong in every generation. And acknowledge what's right in every generation. And that's all that he asks of you. But he does ask that. I tell my young people, my children, my own children, I've given a rule of thumb for their conduct in life. If I had to sit down with them and tell them about everything that comes along, you know, that's bad or good, it'd take all the time I've got. I wouldn't have any time to do anything else. But I've made this rule of thumb with them. Don't do anything, wear anything, or say anything that'll make anybody in the world think you're on the other side of the fence. Don't give them an opportunity to think that. And I don't know of a better approach to morality today. There are a lot of things that are being thrown at us in such rapid pace that we can't absorb it. We can't learn how to decide between these things unless there's a rule of thumb. And here it is for me. I'll not be doing anything. And I'll not let my children, as long as they're under my trainingship, I'll not let them wear anything or say anything or do anything or look like anything that will make other people think that they're a part of the other side. We're a people of a destiny, and we're going somewhere. And we need to recognize that it demands confrontation. Now, this is even to the point you may think of foolishness. My children did at this. They thought the same thing at this. For example, there was a time when one of my boys said, Dad, boy, look at that fellow with that big long fork. Or look at him going down the highway. That's what I'm going to get. He said, I'm going to fix my bicycle like that. I said, no, you won't. We're not going to look like that. Well, what in the world could be wrong with having a long fork? Well, for one thing, it's dangerous, but that's not the point. The point is that I don't want them looking like the people that invented that thing and that use it as a part of the symbol of their movement. I just don't want them being any part of it. Oh, boy, you think, well, that's completely stupid. Well, it may be. But you know one of the hardest things to do as a Christian parent is to be consistent in your stand with your children. That's why the other day when one of my fine boys came home with some high-heel shoes, I took them out to the shed and cut the heel off of them. That's right. This old boy and I have been going at it for years to develop a real live faith, and he's developed it, and I'm thankful to God for him. But here was something that came in. He didn't recognize what they were doing. The world has gotten into us today where they want you to not know whether you're a male or a female. They've got you so sexually disoriented, you don't know who you are. And you boys are looking so much like girls that you don't quite know where you stand. These heels came in, and I thought, you know, it looked like one of these fellows, you know. Uh-huh. No, sir. Not as long as I'm that boy's parent. I took those heels out there, and I chopped them down, and I took them down to the man that prepares shoes, and he put a nice cap on them, and they looked so nice. But all it took was one good chop, and that did it. But I'll tell you what, just like that chop, you're going to have to start doing some chopping. We're going to have to start standing up and being counted. And may I say again, no longer. That's the motto that I'm adopting as far as the attitude toward the world. No longer. Well, the third thing that he says is expose them. Don't have anything to do with them. Don't run with them. Don't have anything to do with the sins. And then thirdly, he says, just simply expose them. How long has it been since you've exposed any sin? Is there any drug on? Are there any drugs on campus? Have you exposed them? Do you know about them? Or are you hiding them? Are you covering up and are you protecting those? Do you know any drug pushers? Or have you exposed them? Do you know any drug users? Have you exposed them? Do you know any people who drink alcohol? Do you know any people who indulge in all of these things? Have you exposed it? If you can save the situation and the sinner, do it. But if you cannot save the sinner, you better save the situation and you better take a stand. Expose them. You can do this negatively. You can say, I want to have no part in it. I'm not going to be a part of that. I love you, but I despise what you're doing and despise what you stand for. And I'm not going to have any part in it. You need to do that negatively. But you need to do it also positively. Can you do anything positive about it? Yes. We can start producing our own music, as the Time of Day did. They cut a record the other day of fine, clean, upstanding music that's very enjoyable. Anybody in his right mind would enjoy it. Brother Davis has been cutting records of the Harding hymns for years and years, and they've obtained and received quite a praise all over the world. We could do that in every department. In our home ec department, we could do it. We could put out a catalog of fashions. You wouldn't want to call it hymns from Harding. What about hymn lines from Harding? Hymn lines from Harding. That's not bad. But why not? Why is it that we're always caught in this vice of being conformed into the world's image? Why can't we stand up and say, no longer? Buster, you've exploited me for the last time. Write Fifth Avenue off and say, no longer are your fashions going to be my fashion. No longer are you going to dictate what I look like and what I smell like and where I go and what I read and what I see. No longer. We're taking a stand. And it'll be confrontation and not coexistence. And God bless us in this. I beg you and I plead with you in the name of Jesus Christ, as Paul makes this statement to the Ephesians, this I affirm and testify in the Lord, that you must no longer live as this nation is living. That's what he's saying to these people back there. Are you ready to take that stand? The time has come. It'll never be riper than right now. And I beg those of you who look so much like the world, who act so much like the world, and whose words are so much like the world, whose everything about you is so much like the world, I beg you to stand up today and take your stand for Jesus Christ. We're all going to stand and sing this song, Stand Up for Jesus. All of us can't respond. Will you respond where you are as you stand? Will you stand up for the Lord Jesus Christ today and make your position known? No longer will I be like the world. I have chosen to follow Jesus Christ, and I will not turn back. We urge you to make that choice today while we stand and sing.